are Paul Tonko, running on the Democratic Working Families Work Women's Equality and Reform Lines, and Joe Vitolo, running on the Republican line. Now it is time to hear their two-minute opening statements. They have drawn lots to determine who goes first, and we will start with Joe Vitolo.
First of all, I want to thank the League of Women Voters for this venue, this opportunity to present my candidacy and an opportunity to see the difference between my opponent and myself. I'll start out with who I am. I was born in a very poor life. My father left when I was 6 years old. He used to come back once a month, beat us up, beat my mother up. I went to 14 different schools in 12 years of education. My mother, when I was 7.5 years old, was sitting on the couch, talking on the phone to the landlord, whispering and crying, saying, "If you just give me a couple of more days, I'll come up with the rent money." I was 7.5, and I said, "Man, I want to help my mommy." And so I went up to her. I said, "Mommy, I'll help you." And she said, "Oh, that's nice, Joseph." Well, what I did was I hopped on my bicycle at 5:30 in the morning. I rode it to Babylon train station. And I brought my little shoe shine kit with me, and I shined shoes at 7.5 years old from 5:30 in the morning till 7:45. Went home, changed my clothes, and handed my mother the $5 that I made shining shoes in 1961. I did that every day for the next 5 years because I wanted to help my mother. I have worked my entire life, and I am going to have the same spirit for those who I represent if elected. I will do whatever it takes to make sure that your needs are met and that your voice is heard. I'm the candidate. I'm a registered nurse now. And I know what it's like to listen to people. I know what it's like to hear where they hurt, when they hurt, and how they hurt, and what to do about it. And when I go to Washington, I will do that for you.
Thank you, Joe. All right, it's time for Paul to opening statement.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you to the League of Women Voters, in particular, those of Saratoga, Rensselaer, and Albany counties, I believe you mentioned. I thank you for the opportunity. I thank Joe Vitolo for the opportunity to join with him and the audience for participating to hear what we have to say. And let me begin by identifying myself as a product of a mill town with a very humble, modest household that enabled me to accomplish my dreams of becoming an engineer. And as an engineer in Washington, it's a rarity, as it is in Albany, but I think we bring problem-solving analytical skills to the equation. Why I want to run for re-election, basically 3 points. First, I want to continue to build on a record of accomplishment. As a Democrat in a Republican-controlled House, I've been able to succeed in getting programmatic policy addressing the opioid epidemic against the odds, but got it done. Was able to achieve the same results with water infrastructure investment so that drinking water infrastructure could be improved upon and where we could assist local governments, state governments in achieving that goal. Second of all, I think the framers of our Constitution, our founding parents, deemed it essential to have checks and balances. I want to make certain that we break this domination where there's not enough check and balance, I think, on the executive branch. I think I can provide that. I think we need to make certain the Mueller investigation is not interrupted and that some of the issues I've seen with poor ethical behavior like that of Administrator Pruitt is checked. And then finally, I want to go out there and make certain I can protect Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, continue to build on healthcare opportunities and protect the pre-existing condition clause protection that was guaranteed in 2010 when we passed the Affordable Care Act. With that, I thank you again for the opportunity and look forward to the evening.
Thank you, Paul. It's time now for questions from the audience, and I believe some people have already lined up. Is that correct? No? Okay, so if you have a question, start towards the back. You should have written it on one of our question cards. If you don't have one, I'm sure we have people handing them out. Okay.
Go ahead. Okay. My name is. Should I be talking?
Yes.
My name is Kathy Weiner, and I live in Clifton Park, right here.
Can everybody hear?
Can you? Oh. Okay. Louder.
Can you?
You have to use the mic.
Oh. Okay. I'm tall. I get taller. Okay. My name is Kathy Weiner, and I live in Clifton Park, right here in Saratoga County, and I have called everybody I know to call, including both of you, your offices. I've received very nice people who are secondary or tertiary people that are working for you, and I have received no response, and I was very, very surprised.
Do you have a question?
Yes, it is. There are no hygiene products provided for women and children by our services from SALT, which used to be welfare right now. So that means there are no products for menstruation.
Your question, please.
Okay.
30 seconds.
Okay, but they have to know what my question is.
Okay.
Okay. And so I'm wondering what you would do, or have you done anything to provide this? This is for people on the street, our shelters.
Okay, the first to answer the questions would be Joe.
Okay, I'm sorry that I didn't catch that you had contacted me, but I will say this. When it comes to providing needs for people on the street, you know, personally, there are a lot of private agencies that are actually doing that. You can go to the Capital City Rescue Mission. You can go to the...
I've called shelters, and they say they don't have enough.
Well, so what we need to do is... I believe in the private sector providing these things. I'm not big on government providing everything.
They don't do it, regularly.
I
was a teacher.
Let him answer the question.
Okay.
I don't believe that the government really needs to be... the sole provider of these things. I think the truth is that the private sector should have the right, or should be given the privilege to do that. And the reason why the private sector has not responded as well as it has is because BIB government has taxed them to death. And so they feel like I'm giving to the government so I don't have to give to the public. And the government has done a lousy job in providing those things. So let's free up the private sector and give them incentive to do those things, because the private sector will do it better than the government. I mean, look at the way they run the post office. Look at the way the government runs other things. The government doesn't do that, but the private sector, when it comes to people being charitable, they do a much better job.
Thank you, Joe.
Kathy, thank you for your question. And I believe that many times government policy is established because the private sector will not go there or cannot go there. So I think that it befalls government to respond and respond sensitively. It should be sensitive to gender, and it should be sensitive to dignity for the individual. I'm associated with a measure introduced by Representative Barbara Lee of California that would allow for coverage of hygiene products because, again, it's a dignity factor and one that speaks with great sensitivity. I think that when we do that, we enable the approach to be holistic. We're looking at the basic needs of an individual, and women and children should, you know, some of that has not been taken as kindly and sensitively as it should. I thank you for raising that question, and I'm supportive of the effort, and we need to make certain that we don't gut these programs, as has been the case over the attempt over the last several months and a couple of years now with the latest spin through the administration.
I just found when I...
Thank you. Thank you. We'll go on to another question. I'm sorry. You can talk to them afterwards, perhaps. All right? And I would just like to tell the people who want to ask a question, for the woman who is next, would you stay here? Would the rest of you line up in the back? Could you stay in line but go to the back, because... The reason is people can't see. So we're lining up from the back, and you will come forward when it's your turn. Okay? Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Is this okay?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Hi. Oh, my name is Jackie. I live in Schenectady. So for Mr. Vitolo and Representative Tonko, I just want to know how each of you, your plans for ensuring the continuation of Social Security for us, children, grandchildren, all the way down the road, a simple, perhaps, solution.
Thank you for your question.
My turn.
Paul.
Yes. Thank you. And thank you, Jackie, for your question. Certainly, making certain that we protect Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, as I mentioned in my opening statement, is absolutely essential. It's a safety net that wraps around many of our families. I've watched with aged parents what happens in our society, and it's important to have that security, that underpinning. And so I will continue to fight to make certain that we don't gut these programs. Now, we borrowed $2.3 trillion for a tax cut that went primarily to the world's largest corporations and the wealthiest Americans. That bothers me now that, don't take my word for it, take it that of the Republican leaders in Washington. Senator Mitch McConnell indicated that Medicaid and Medicare are the reason that we're having these budget woes and that we need to go and rein those in. Well, I'm on a bill that would allow for Social Security to be further strengthened by requiring those over $400,000 to pay their fair contribution into the program and making certain that we provide an immediate benefit of COLA for Social Security, and that we also strengthen that trust fund and make certain that the improvements that come through time where they revisit COLA adjustments are based on those factors that really affect seniors, the cost of heating fuel, the cost of pharmaceuticals, and the like, and not based on large screen televisions and commercial products that have nothing to do with the essentials for a senior to survive and live comfortably.
Thank you, Paul. Joe?
Well, when it comes to Social Security, we need to start with one of the major problems with Social Security, and that is that since 1963, Congress has been allowed to borrow against Social Security. My opponent borrowed twice against Social Security for the very first time in congressional history, back in 2012 and 2010. They borrowed $125 billion without the issuing of bonds, the first time in congressional history that they did that, which means they have no intention of paying it back. So my opponent is responsible for borrowing $250 billion from Social Security. So to say that he wants to keep it stable is a little bit of a false statement if you're going to borrow against it. I want to mark that they have never borrowed against the federal program that provides his retirement. And so that when it comes to being just and honest and wanting to secure Social Security, and by the way, I am 100% behind not only securing Social Security and its payments to those who have paid in, but also that the Congress over the next 10 years will be responsible to pay back the $3.9 trillion that they owe Social Security that they've been borrowing since 1963. And that that money will never be able to be borrowed against again, so that seniors and future generations will have that money there.
Thank you. Yes, Paul. A red card?
Yes, please. Look, let me set the record straight. There's no one who has fought harder to keep Social Security from privatization. And I think that is the effort underway. The borrowing that you're talking about well occurred way before my days in Washington, or they rolled into a budget process so that the vote on a budget was either straight yes or no. But I will say that—
Joe, this is Paul's time to talk.
I will say that with privatization, I will remind this audience and any of us in the 20th Congressional District that during the Great Recession, there were those who lost their lifetime's worth of savings that they entrusted through portfolio management, and it was attacked by greed during the recession. That's what happens with privatization. And I'm talking about not losing a single cent of Social Security payment, which was indeed the case during that whole ultimate recession and the recovery period. So I think it's important for us to maintain and stabilize and strengthen the trust fund for Social Security.
Thank you, Paul. We have another red card?
Yes, ma'am. So my response to that is that the stabilization and the strengthening of it will come with the repayment of it. It is time that Congress stops borrowing against Social Security. Social Security is not the bank account so that Congress can balance their budget. And if indeed you're in favor of stabilizing Social Security, then you would just go ahead and say, all right, well, listen, since we can't borrow against Social Security, let's borrow against the federal plan that protects me. I think that it's time that Congress starts to hold itself to the same place that they expect us, the average citizens who have worked their entire life and put money away in Social Security, expecting it to be there. And then you turn around and you say, oh, gee, it's not solvent. It's not solvent because Congress is gutting it, not the administration.
Thank you, Joe. We have time for another question.
I agree with you that the federal government should not be paying for private endeavors. And so I would like to know if the Republican Party will be reimbursing the federal government for what it's costing the taxpayers to fly the president around the country campaigning. And by the way, it costs $206,000 an hour every time that plane leaves the ground. That's not counting what it's costing the second plane that bears the helicopter and the presidential limo. Can you answer that question?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I don't believe that.
Audience, please hold your.
I do not believe that.
And this question will go first to Joe. So yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
All right. When it comes to reimbursement, we can go back to the previous administration.
I want to know.
One moment. I'm answering the question. The previous administration did exactly the same thing.
No.
Yes, they did, ma'am. And the previous administration also used Air Force Two for cultural experience. And I think that the Air Force One and Air Force Two shouldn't be used for these processes. And when it comes to paying it back, well, I think you're going to have a hard road to get them to do. Do I think they should be doing it? No, they should be doing it on their own private sense. And I would like to know why none of the presidents have ever said, if they're going to go campaign for someone, this is on my bill, this is on my wallet. So I'm going to tell you, you're right. Something needs to be fixed with the process. The process is wrong. So if we're going to talk about reimbursement, we'll talk about reimbursement for the last two administrations at least.
We're not having a conversation here. He is answering your question, please.
My turn.
Yes, if Joe's finished.
Well, yeah. Okay. So, again, when it comes to this administration, there are things that people disagree with. And when it came to the previous administration, there were things that people disagreed with the use of Air Force One and Air Force Two.
Okay, now, Paul?
Okay, there are a number of ethical concerns that I have. You know, you had a requirement to dissolve yourself of a big private sector business, and that really didn't get resolved correctly. We're supposed to trust their word that they're not associating in the White House with any of that business venture. It's also the great number of family members who are part of the White House staff that exploit that payment beyond belief. And it's run amok, I believe. I agree with you that it needs to be reined in. The travel availabilities are there to enable the president to address policy, but no one's talking now about all the campaign activity. And we see these rallies. They're labeled, not by me, by him, as rallies. And we're traveling to all these states trying to make certain that the House doesn't flip or that the Senate doesn't flip. And we're out there in feverish effort to campaign for countless numbers of candidates, and no one is getting reimbursed. The taxpayer is not getting reimbursed with all of this travel. So I think it's an unethical bit of behavior, one that does not set a good tone at a time when people want more accountability and transparency in their government.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I think I want to talk just one brief moment about etiquette. If you're coming to ask a question, you have 30 seconds. Keep it concise, and then allow the candidates to answer. It's not a conversation, okay? And the candidates, I would caution you as well not to make any motions or responses to while the other person is talking.
Hi, my name is Petros. I'm from Cohoes. And the question I have is, so your senators at Congress have a term limit? If not, why not? And what are you going to do about it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Paul,
go sure. First. I don't favor term limits. I think that every 2 years, the House of Representatives, and every 6 years, the United States Senators are up for a report card. I think the people judge whether or not that person has acted accordingly, has provided the sort of ethical effort that they expect and deserve. I also know that there are assignments that you get. For instance, my assignments are energy and commerce and science, space, and technology. It takes quite a while to learn the policy, to develop the arguments, to develop the public positions of your colleagues with whom you need to participate to get things done. I think that it's very important that we enable people to develop expertise in areas, and that takes time. I think limiting that to a few short terms is unnatural. We had folks like Mike McNulty and Sam Stratton who preceded me in this role, and I think their service is still highly regarded, and they would have not been able to produce for the district for the many years that they did had they been term limited. So I think that the voters have, the general public has a strength there in their report cards for each and every member of Congress.
Okay, thank you. Joe?
Well, I do believe in term limits. And the reason why I believe in term limits is because the founding fathers never intended for anyone to come and spend a lifetime in Washington building up power, money, and control in order to force through things that and agendas that were not beneficial to the public, to the citizenry, to the very electorate that is before us today. When it comes to term limits, I think that I want to say a few short terms. I think that there's nothing wrong with saying if the president can get it done in 8 years, then Congress should be able to get it done in 8 years. 8 years is long enough. The problem is people get into power and they build up huge bank accounts and they build up huge power control bodies and they manipulate. For instance, Congress is allowed to invest in a company that if they think it's going to be benefited when they vote for a bill, they can invest in that company. And when they do, they're doing insider trading. That's illegal. Why aren't we making decisions to stop congressmen? And I know that there's a bill out there to stop that, and I know Paul is on the bill, but that doesn't mean that it's going to pass. And that doesn't mean that they're going to change it because they like insider trading. They make themselves rich and they develop too much control in a short period of time.
Thank you, Joe. And it looks like we have a red card.
Yes, and thank you, Ann. I think that broad brushing the behavior of members of Congress is unfair. I think people can sift through that. There is a Stock Act. Stop trading on congressional knowledge. That was developed and passed. It was sponsored by Louise Slaughter, the late Louise Slaughter, who passed this year, a dear friend of mine. I took action just before we broke for the election recess to rename that Stock Act after Louise Slaughter, because it was just that kind of behavior that she targeted. We should not be gaming that information for our own good. We should be there and put constituents first. By the way, with term limits, it took me, I think, 8 years to get the mental health parity bill done, to build an audience, to inform my constituents and my colleagues about the good that mental health parity would bring, where no one would be stepchilded. They would get the insurance coverage that they rightly deserve. The same was true in working on water infrastructure programmatic outcomes. The success for me took some 6 years. It takes a while. The founding parents, yes, they framed our Constitution and our system of government, but my friends, we are living in very complex issues that require complex solutions and that take a bit of time to develop. And I don't think that developing expertise is a bad thing for the constituents.
Thank you. Another red card.
All right. I'm responding actually to what my opponent said. He said he has worked hard for the healthcare community, for the mental health community. And I'm sure there are things that he has done and things that he's been involved in. But there's a section of the mental health community he has greatly overlooked, because they're not at his charity events that he goes and shakes hands with the rich and famous and gets an incredible amount of campaign money from. When you have someone in the mental health community who has been abused and has not been helped by the state or the state agencies that are in place, and then they bring their case to my opponent, a girl who was nonverbal, who was wheelchair bound, who was raped and died from a disease that she contracted from being raped. When that case was brought to my opponent said it is strictly a state issue. That's a violation of her civil rights. That was a violation of her federal law, and it is Medicare fraud, those homes not providing a safe environment for those girls. If he's going to say he stands up for the mental health community, he ought to do it for the mental health community that can't speak for themselves.
Okay, looks like it's time for a question now.
Hi, my name's Sergeia Coffey. I'm from Boston Spa. I'm asking about military spending and military activity. We spend more than the next seven countries. We are have sent our soldiers to over 72 different countries right now, that including Syria, longest war in Afghanistan. We are supporting Saudi's attack on Yemen, which is one of the greatest humanitarian tragedies in history, they're saying, famine-wise. The Congress has the ability, is supposed to be, have the ability to declare war or to stop funding. If the Democrats win the Congress, what will you do?
Okay.
Or if they don't, what will you do to pull back to military spending and bring our soldiers home?
Okay, first is Joe Vitolo.
All right, first of all, I agree with you wholeheartedly that only Congress can declare war. And there are a number of actions that have taken place that should have started with Congress or not started at all. So I agree with you. I do also believe that there are a lot of military actions that are taking place that should be curtailed. But when it comes to military spending, it is very important that we have a strong, advanced military, because you can only have a strong defense if you have a strong offense. We have to have the, we have to be ahead of all the other nations when it comes to technology, when it comes to strength, because if we're going to speak, we're going to have to be able to speak with something to back it up. Very important, whether it's Democrats in control or whether it's Republicans in control, when a nation starts to move in a certain direction, we should be able to, when we speak, say, this is the power that we have behind us, and they should fear that. They should fear that. Do I think that we're being bullies that way? No, but when it comes to democracy, when it comes to democracy, which we herald in this country, and fairness, we need to be able to defend countries that can't defend themselves.
Thank you, Joe. Paul?
Thank you. I agree with Joe Vitolo that Congress should have a greater role in determining what conflicts we enter into. I think that we've abandoned that power and we need to bring it back. I think, again, it's a checks and balance. However, I will say this. I believe that our troops are exhausted. We've been in the midst of one of the longest wars, the longest war with Afghanistan. The taxpayers are exhausted. They cannot continue to pay for war, and we can't do it alone. We can't go it alone. We need our allies. That's why I get very concerned when President Trump has lined up with dictators like Mr. Putin of Russia and Kim Jong-un from North Korea, and at the same time, can I have a little attention here, please?
I'm sorry. Would we have quiet in the room, please?
Thank you. When you align yourself with folks like that, you damage the relations with our allies, with whom we need to partner so that we can relieve the taxpayer and relieve the exhausted troops. And I think it's important for all of that to be done in concert. We need to know the strategy, and we need to go forward and implement the plan, but we need to know the strategy. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Next question.
Hi, my name is Al. I'm from Clifton Park. This is for both candidates. In your opinion, and this is about private sector versus public sector, which Mr. Vitola mentioned. In your opinion, what should be the responsibilities and roles of the private versus public sectors in providing for the common good, if you believe in the common good, and in providing safety nets for economic security, healthcare, physical security, and so on? And what underlying principles guide your decisions?
I believe we're starting with Paul this time.
Sure. Thank you, Al. I think that certainly there should be public-private partnership with a lot of this. I think that, you know, when people talked about a socialized model for healthcare, it's not accurate. We have a private sector insurance program that we did with the ACA, but have put guidelines into it. I think policy initiatives and guidance and principles that can accompany that investment are important. So issues like pre-existing conditions, issues like discontinuing coverage in the midst of a catastrophic illness, filling the donut hole so that seniors don't have to reach into their pocket for the Medicare portion that they've been reaching to. Those sorts of things are an assistance that come from government or guidelines and principles that are established. I think that, you know, there's a reason government steps in. People say, well, let the capitalism rule. I believe in capitalism, but then you need guidelines to check where there's unfairness or injustice that begins to creep into the given situation. And I think that partnership is one that's valid, one that allows for both public and private sectors to maintain a strength, if you will, for job growth in our economy and a quality of life and quality of services that are provided.
Thank you. Paul, is that it? Joe?
I do believe in the private sector, and there is a role to be played in the government also. I think that it is the government's role is policy. The private sector's role is action. I work as a nurse, all right? I'm a registered nurse. I work in the emergency room. There is, and by the way, I believe in protecting pre-existing conditions. We have always protected pre-existing conditions in the state of New York. And we and the president has said that he will never take away pre-existing conditions from anything when it comes to the insurance. He just came out and said that publicly. But I will say that the Affordable Health Care Act has punished numerous people, particularly our elderly. Just last night, there was a lady, she came into the emergency room, and they said, we're going to admit you on the observation status. Observation status is an extension of the emergency room. So they'll pay a copay for every x-ray, a copay for every blood draw, a copay for every medication, a copay. This woman refused the observation status because she said when she walked out of the hospital last time on an observation status, she had a $2,700 bill of copays. We need to get rid of that. I see it in action, and I know where the problems are. I'm not saying we need to abandon it.
Thank you, Joe.
I don't feel my question was answered.
We don't have any more red cards.
What do you mean by that?
Sorry. Well, they're just two. And you've both already used two. I'm sorry.
Okay. I'm sorry. I had asked you before the debate if these were good throughout the course of the questions, and you implied yes. But that's okay.
I misunderstood you. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But you may address something that has already been talked about at another time if you stay within your time.
That's fine, Ann. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Steve Catanzaro from Clifton Park. I'm a disabled vet, and I have spent 31 years in the financial services industry. I want to make a quick statement and then the question regarding Social Security. When it was established, Social Security had 25 people paying into a system with one person receiving benefits. As of 2016, we have now gone from two people paying in to one person collecting benefits. Anybody who can do first grade math realizes that we have a disaster on our hands. That being said, There was a bill proposed to take away veterans' pensions, or not active duty members, and giving them a 401k.
Can you finish quickly? Your time is up.
And my question is, being that you as a congressman and all the state federal employees have defined benefit pensions after one term, and military members have to spend 20 years, do you think that that is a just and prudent way that we would spend our money, where people spend 20 years of their life, risking their life every day, and gut their ability to have a defined benefit pension, but yet you people on the Hill get your pensions after one term in office for 50% of your salary, which is then passed on to
your
significant
other?
Okay.
I think you misstated that. There's not a 50% of your salary after one term. That is totally wrong. It's 0.5% of your salary after 5 years of service, and then per year. So you're way inflating the pension
can
benefit.
Can we
step back? Well, no, but I just wanted to correct that, because that's gross misinformation.
Joe was to answer first.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. So first of all, when it comes to veterans, I am a strong advocate for veterans. I would make sure that veterans' hospitals are well funded. I would make sure that veterans are well taken care of. They have shed their blood for the freedom that we enjoy. They've given their lives, they've given limbs, and I've lost many friends and relatives, some right in Afghanistan itself. So I think that I would say that Congress, So when the benefits of Congress continue, or Senate continues, after they leave their term in office, I think that the Founding Fathers never intended for Congress to be like that. You go, you serve, and then you go back home and you work your job, you live your life, and you provide for yourself and your family. They did receive salaries, and that's fine while they're there. But I don't believe that Congress should have the same kind of benefits, which is what, by the way, makes them want to push for no term limits, because they want to be able to just keep going to get as much as they can. And I do not believe that it is as much service-oriented as it should be.
Thank you, Joe. Paul?
Yeah. I'm not on the Veterans Committee, nor was I on the Veterans Committee when I was in the State Assembly. But have
duty.
Pardon me? Right.
As opposed to a defined benefit.
Right. So I'm not on the committee. I know that there have been various bills brought forth, and would obviously encourage my colleagues who serve on that committee to push the effort so that it can come to the floor for a vote. Obviously, I would support our disabled vets. I support our vets in general, but disabled vets, absolutely a high priority. I want to use my last 1 minute to speak to the efforts of President Trump and pre-existing condition protection. There was, in the tax law, an outcome that provided for probably a guaranteed, according to the CBO, a guaranteed 10% increase in premiums because of that tax adjustment that also puts at risk the pre-existing condition. And you have a number of Republican attorneys general in this country that have filed a suit before the courts to make certain that pre-existing condition protection is struck down. So I think it's fair to state that there's been an orchestrated attempt to attack that tremendous dynamic within the ACA.
Okay, thank you. Just as a point, the gentleman wanted to ask us a second question. We're not doing that this evening in hopes of getting as many questions from you as possible, and I'm very pleased to see that a lot of people are still waiting to ask. So please don't engage a conversation. That's not what we're doing tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Steve Jarrett from Niskayuna. It is common for the presidential candidates to release their medical information from exams they've had from physicians of their choice. Would you be in favor of having all presidential candidates undergo neuropsychiatric evaluations by the NIH with release of that information to the public? If so, would you be willing to institute a bill in that regard? And if not, why not? Yeah.
Time is up. Okay. And the question goes to Paul first.
Sure. I'm not certain there may be bills of that type. I know that there have been some additional conditions that they placed, including tax records. I think that, your willingness to serve deserves the sort of scrutiny from the general public. And whatever we can provide as guidelines to make certain that people have the information at their fingertips is important. And I think that, we're not only electing a president of the United States, but in a sense, a leader of the free world. So, I believe there are probably some bills in the hopper, but we can check.
Thank you, Paul. Joe?
I believe that all of people's health needs to be revealed when they are holding an office like that. And so as far as a mental health exam, I think that it's as valid as any other kind of an exam. And should there be a bill that mandates it? I really don't know. I've never heard of such a thing, but I think it's a good expectation for anyone. Just like if someone you're going to hire someone to be the CEO of a company, you would want them to be a good mental health and as well as good physical health, because they're directing the policies and where a country goes from there, or where a company goes from there. So I do want to get back to though one issue, and that is that again I will state this: I will not allow pre-existing conditions to be pulled out of any health care plan. It's very important that people be able to be protected in their health care plan and not be prejudiced against. And in my experience in the emergency room, I have yet to see one person turned away. I've been a registered nurse for 16 years, not only in the emergency room, but also in the ICU. And hospitals and doctors go above and beyond to assist people.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Okay, this is going to go to Joe first.
I'm Sheila Alfaso, I live locally, and my question is, it has to do with your voting record. As a congressman or private citizen, what have you accomplished for the voters?
We're starting with Joe.
Well, I've never held a political office before in my life. I'm just the average working class guy, and I have done
it. Nothing to do with it. I want to know, in your life, what have you done that would be considered positive for the voters?
Okay, well, I have worked on numerous community activities. I have volunteered. I had a business, a construction company. I took my entire construction company over to, at that time, I lived in Coxsackie. And we provided, I actually paid them to work and help build a playground for the children. I've also worked on a community board that prevented BFI, which is now under Consolid Waste Management, from making a landfill with toxic remains from New York City to be put into a valley bed that would feed the water supply for a particular community. So I've worked on community boards to help the environment. I've worked on the community boards to help the community. And I have volunteered my services with unwed mothers and homeless people. We've taken both into our own home. If you read my daughter's biography of me, she says, we always had people in our house. My dinner table was always open. Sometimes a hitchhiker going down the road, I'd get in conversation with them and invite them in for dinner.
Thank you, Joe. Paul?
Before my days in elected office and during my tenure in elected office, I've been working very closely with a number of human services agencies, not-for-profit organizations, to empower them to address cures for diseases, services for people who struggle with various health conditions, and have made that a major goal in my life. I have also, before my assembly days, and continuing throughout, have fought for water protection, making certain pollutants, contaminants, we're not entering into our water systems, and making certain that we have sound environmental policy to guide us and be sounder stewards of the environment. I think that's very important in my track record, mental health parity, infrastructure investment, workforce development, the list goes on and on. I just want to address again the pre-existing condition issue. I think it's important to note that we'll need, if Joe wins this election, we'll need his voice in the Republican caucus, because they passed a measure that said that pre-existing conditions should be left to the states. Now, I asked a mom the other day who stood for that same outcome, if your daughter had a brain tumor, should it require which state she lives in to get the service she requires?
Thank you, Paul. Okay, next question.
My name is Kathy Young, and I'm from Clifton Park. I have seen many presidents now in office and having left office. I don't know how many, but it's a number. I have never in my life seen anything like the divisiveness and the anger in this country as it is today. I also have never seen anything like the resist movement. Now, I know that during the debates—
Do you have a question?
Yes. During the debates, it was said that not accepting the results of the election was undermining our democracy. So my question is, what has Resist done in a positive way for this country? Isn't it just another way for the Democratic Party to undermine the results of the election, thereby endangering democracy? Thank you.
Okay, the question goes to Paul first.
Well, I don't think it's, I think Resist is speaking to a number of concerns that they have for sound policy and healthcare protection, the fair treatment of women in many cases, the anti-feminist effort that might have been brought to bear. I think people have spoken out, and they want to make certain they're expressing their concerns, their priorities, and I find nothing wrong with that. What I would emphasize is that all of us in elected office and all of us in society in general, but primarily upon elected leaders and starting with the president at the top, should understand that words matter, and that if we're leading a nation, it should also be by example, and that there should be this ethic that says words matter, there should be a civility to our society that is uniquely American, where we respect varying degrees of arguments and different opinions, but we do not make it personal. We do not attack various creeds, gender, whatever, ethnic groups. I think that, you know, some of the last couple of days have reminded us that tone is important, words matter, and that we should emphasize and underscore the value of civility in our society.
I absolutely agree. And my question is then, why has not my opponent spoken out against Maxine Waters? Why has my opponent not spoken out against those who go after people who are in office while they're sitting in a restaurant with their families or with their friends? Why, if you believe in civility and you believe that words matter, and I do, I would personally, I would have spoken out, whether it was against, if it was against a Democrat, it's not right. But it's okay. We don't speak against people like Maxine Waters, I guess, and we don't speak against people like Nancy Pelosi, your hero, and we don't speak against people like Chuck Schumer, who advance this aggressive behavior instead of saying, let's be civil, let's bring a right tone. Why don't we do the right thing? So my, you know, my answer to that question is that there is this side's allowed to do this this thing, but this side is not allowed to. We need to make it fair for both sides, and we need to speak out about that.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Next question.
My name is Darnell, and I'm from Clifton Park, and that segues right into my question. Research has shown that there is a correlation between what top officials say and people's attitudes. Hateful rhetoric from the top politicians and commentators gives unstable people permission to do hateful things. What are you going to do at your level of government to stop this?
First answer is Joe.
Okay, personally, I will not have hateful speech. I will not. Say that one side is horrible and the other side is accepting. One side is right and this side, both people have a voice. When and if I am elected, I am going to be the voice for both sides, not for just my party. As a matter of fact, I turned down a large sum of money for my campaign because I refused to say I will always vote with the party. I said that I will vote for the people, and I will not be influenced by a party. I will not be influenced by a corporation. I will not be influenced by any big money that comes my way. We have had a grassroots organization and a grassroots effort here, and we are doing very well with our campaign. So I would say that when it comes to civility and when it comes to right words and it comes to aggression, that I would set the example and the tone and speak up for what is right, not always for what is party popular.
Okay, Paul.
Thank you. In the last couple of days, I've gathered at synagogues in Albany and Schenectady, where people of all faiths joined in supporting and comforting the Jewish community. A hate crime wiped out several Jews in Pittsburgh. There are repeated statements made of hate via crime and murder. I find it regrettable. It's very difficult to legislate personal behavior. I commit to ethical behavior and withholding hateful speech. I'm about inclusion, about respect for folks. I will encourage my colleagues to do likewise. And if you go to my statements made in media, social media, or through press releases, you'll never see hateful message. We'll talk analytically. I love to problem solve, and that's the way I conduct myself. Joe, I think there's some very harsh statements made on your social media, and I need to acknowledge that here this evening. I think it's very hateful, and I regret it.
Okay, thank you. It looks like we may have time for about two more questions. Do we have any more? You have one more after this? No, this is the last one.
I'm Josh. I go to a school in Schenectady. So my question to the candidates is, what are your thoughts on prison reform in the private prison industry? And what actions would you take to stop the flow of the overwhelming amount of people in our prisons?
All right, and the question goes first to Paul.
Well, I think there's alternatives to incarceration that ought to be looked at. We shouldn't be warehousing people. As I have said, I worked very much on the heroin epidemic and the opioid epidemic. When you're warehousing people, it's unfortunate. I think we need programs that can turn lives around. We need to make certain that we're approaching that with dignity, because the investment we're now making in prison is deplorable. We need to invest in education. We need to reach youngsters earlier so that they don't go down that pathway to crime. It's unfair that we don't emphasize our education investment in relation to that of incarceration. But if people are incarcerated, there should be every effort made to rehabilitate. I think it's absolutely important. And when it comes to schools, because you're a student, I will tell you we need to really work hard at school safety and common sense gun legislation so that we are not making those institutions something that's impacted by violence, but rather a place where you can come in comfort to learn.
Thank you. Joe?
When it comes to prison reform and when it comes to our inmate population, I think there's a very important factor. Part of it is that there needs to be not only a sense of that we do want to reform people, but provide an avenue for that to take place. I, if elected, would be very much involved in doing or putting forth bills that would promote that. Personally, I volunteered in a prison, not only on a religious basis, but also on a public basis, tutoring and training young men and women in math and science, which are some of my strong points. I think that we need to get public sector involvement. I actually hired someone out of the prison to work in my company when I had my own construction company. I think that we need to get the private sector involved in part of that restoration. And as far as students is concerned, I think students as well could be a part of that process in helping these young men and women who are in facilities who need a sense of connection so that they are not in this whole isolation mentality. When you're in a prison, there's an isolation. And so in order to keep some kind of a community contact, so long it is not dangerous for the person who's involved.
All right, thank you. If there are there any more questions? Would you, have you written it down?
No.
Okay, well, come forward and say your question. You have 30 seconds.
Well, gentlemen, I'm
You don't have to run, that's okay.
I'm from Rotterdam. Are you pro-life or are you pro-choice and why?
All right, so the question goes to Joe.
Okay, I am pro-life. And the reason is because I believe that life begins at the moment of conception, and I believe that we need to provide for the safety of the child in the womb, which is the most safest place for a child. I believe that we need to protect the child all the way up to birth, unlike my opponent, who does agree in with partial birth abortion, right up to the day of delivery. And I hold very strongly to my pro-life views. I have taken unwed mothers. My wife and I have taken unwed mothers into our house. We have provided also counseling services for women who choose to abort their babies. We don't condemn them because they've made a choice, a very hard choice. And sometimes there's some emotional struggles that they have after doing that. And we want to love them and say that we don't judge them because they made that choice. We're going to love them and we're going to help them through maybe some of the good or bad choices that they've made. So yes, I am pro-life, solidly pro-life.
Thank you, Joe.
Paul? Thank you. Thank you, Ann. I vote pro-choice. I think in a pluralistic society where people practice a faith, a variety of faiths that are out there, or don't embrace a faith, the grid is there for you to insert your religious values, your tenets, your faith in an appropriate way. I myself have my own religious beliefs about various elements that you just mentioned, but again, because of a pluralistic society, I vote pro-choice.
Okay, all right. So if there are no more questions, we will move to closing statements. And I want to caution both candidates that this is not your time to punch somebody else in the nose. It is time to give us your positive energy and vision and determination, what issues you want to work on in a positive way. And we're going to have Joe go first.
Well, when it comes to being a congressman, I believe that part of that is to serve and to listen, to hear what people have to say. If elected, one of the things I would do was I would have a town hall, one town hall every week while in session. While not in session, I would have at least two, possibly three town halls so that we could hear the people instead of going to public events where there are ribbon cuttings and things of that nature. Although that's important to acknowledge great accomplishments, It's also important to take your time and to really allow people to speak to you, people who don't go to those events, who you won't bump into. Go to their town, go to their home, feel their pain, hear what they're saying, and listen. I've cried with people as a registered nurse. I prayed with people as a registered nurse. I sing with people as a registered nurse. And I will do that with the public.
Okay. Paul?
Thank you, Anna. Thank you again to the League for the great opportunity. Let me put three areas of build together that are my goals if reelected to Congress. First, build the individual and family. Make certain that we reinforce the efforts of the Affordable Care Act, not repeal it, only make it stronger. Bend the cost curve on pharmaceutical prescription costs. Make certain that we have workforce development programs that will enable the people to assume jobs that are very precision-oriented in an innovation economy, and making certain that, again, we have solved the opioid epidemic. Second, infrastructure, building our physical infrastructure, not just roads and bridges, but our water, drinking water, water sewer, our grid modernization, broadband access that is necessary, rail safety. And finally, the infrastructure of our government, making certain that we have accountability and transparency, making certain that campaign finance reform is real so that we are more driven by the many than the money. We're the government of the many. Let's make certain we have those infrastructure improvements. So thank you again for your kind opportunity here this evening.
Thank you, Paul, and I want to thank both candidates and an audience for being respectful.